travelers, and welcome to the Way of the Showman, where we view the world through the lens of showmanship. I am Captain Frodo, and I will be your host and gracious guide along this leg of the way. And this particular trip that we have been going on here for the last five, and now this will be the sixth trip that we take, or episodes, we have been talking about what play is, or at least we have been preparing to talk about what play is, and we're talking about the relationship between showmanship and play. So in episode 97, we sketched out the showman and the audience and what happens between the two of them, how that the show that then emerges is a different domain in episode. So we talked about that in relation to geometry, and that to see how when a line becomes a triangle, it has many similar aspects to this. Then in the last episode, in 98, we talked about, or at least asked the question, what, if anything, can we say about what goes on in this here area of interest, the space of shared attention between a showman and the audience. When a showman walks out onto the stage and the audience is paying attention, and the audience starts to groove on what the showman has to show them, as this happens, at some point they lean in. The room colors red, as Nala says. I spoke about Nala Lanala's sister last episode, and we're going to get back to him, but he calls that painting the room. Oh, that the room color's red. I'm just saying that that's when the interest comes, when attention, well, they got the attention. You get the attention of an audience if you pop a paper bag when they don't expect it. But if you get them to get really excited, they'll lean forward. And in that moment, they sort of wish themselves, and they suspend their disbelief, or they allow the performance to take seed in their mind, and it grows and becomes a new thing. And what, if anything, did we ask in the last episode, what, if anything, can be said that's general about what goes on in this space, in the realm of the show? What kind of behaviors can we reliably find in here? And this is where I leant on Nala's work, the work of Nala Slavsky, as he calls it, in his book, The Clown Manifesto, and he boils it down to two things, and I'm not going to go through all the details for that, because you can go back to the last episode and just check it out. And he talks about connection. The first thing that the performer does when he comes out onto that stage and the audience is there, you want to connect immediately. You come out, I am here, you are there, I acknowledge that you're here, and we are going to create something together. You catch their attention by giving them the attention, and this reciprocal thing that is super powerful. Super powerful when we come out, and important. And then as we then go on and we start to do anything at all, how should that thing be done? It should be done playfully. We are going out and there is an element of play in what we do. Even if we are very seriously, the play aspect is what draws the audience in, and that makes them feel like something is going to happen. This is going somewhere, but we don't know where. And you set up these little games, and you gotta lock onto that game and just play it. But if any audience member, or let's say you're doing a family show and a child walks up onto the stage, you gotta stick to your game. But at any time, you gotta be prepared to expand the rules to include whatever they might be throwing at you. So we've talked about all of this, we've talked about what showmanship is, and we are now finally reaching the point where we can start to look at what play is. So that is the aim of today's episode. So without further ado, let's jump into the world of ideas and explore and get an understanding of what play is. So what is play? Now, play is, as we have spoken about, and as we've spoken a lot about on this podcast, it is not a thing. It's a process. So play is so many things that we're going to have to sort of explain and look at this from several points of view. And along the way of looking at it from different points of view, we will discover themes and features of play that emerges. And through this, we will build our understanding. So one of the things that I was thinking of which I don't know if I've actually put into what I'm going to say today, but I was trying to put it down as short as I could of what play is. So this isn't really a definition, but I just see it here in my notes. So I thought I'd just start by that and saying that play is not a thing in itself. It's a process, but it's not a thing in itself. And that process is more like a mode of experiencing and interacting with reality. So play is not something that's over there or that's over here. It's something that happens between two agents, as sometimes it's called, two beings, you know, or several beings. So play is not a thing in itself, but a mode of experience. It's a way to experience the world or a way to interact with reality. So, with all that said, let's start this exploration of what play is by me telling you about walking my dog Teddy in the forest. So, most mornings after walking my girl to school, I go for a long walk in the forest with my little pomchi dog that's called Teddy. He's half Pomeranian and half Chihuahua, and he's a perfect image of a little fluffy fox. And most people think of a cute little fluffy dog as a best fit for like a Hollywood celebrity's handbag, but this little fella loves big walks, running in the rain and the mud, and to race like a sand-colored lightning bolt over the soft ground beneath the fir trees, and the deep layer of fir needles that's been made from decades worth of fallen pine needles, and it creates this springy, soft surface for him to get a real great grip and not to hurt his little paws when he's doing hairpin turns and rapid starts and stops and jumps, little it's like little pirouettes. In short, it's a perfect area for stimulating a dog's desire to play. And the first bit of the walk is steep and partly exposed to rocks and mountain, but once we sort of reach the top after we've climbed a steep hill, then we begin the descent into the forest proper. And Teddy's behavior starts to change when we get here. He starts to zoom around the trees, stopping intermittently to see if I'm paying attention to him. And if I am, if I'm present there in the moment with him, sharing this glorious moment of now, which dogs seem to pretty permanently be in, then, because I don't always pay attention to him. Sometimes I'm busy writing down ideas in my notes app on my phone and I'm distracted. But sometimes, you know, he's not paying attention. Sometimes another dog has left a scent trail which distracts the Teddy from playing. But more often than not, he abruptly stops, looks at me, and as we get eye contact, we both kind of freeze. And I can practically feel him vibrating like a via plucked string that I can't hear. And in this sort of frozen stillness, as we stare at each other, like two gunslingers in a Sergio Leone Western standoff, then he's just looking for a cue. He starts lowering his front. Like, and he goes down as I'm looking, his tension builds, and he just bends down, like he's sort of bowing, putting his elbows, or if you can call them that, on the ground and lying down with his bum in the air and completely fixed on me. So he bows, chest to the ground, eyes fixed on me. And this bow is his invitation to play. He's literally telling me that I want to play with you. He's telling me that in what's to come, the meaning of our behaviors will transform. He will bark. He might bite, he will run away and chase me, and I will shout at him and aggressively chase him. But his little bow is signaling me that all what comes next now will not be what it seems. A bite, I mean, it won't be what it seems. A bite will still be a bite in a way that it means that he managed to bite my hand when I was pushing him around, but he will not bite hard. He will only mark the bite, like a martial artist will mark a punch or a chop or whatever. And even though he is biting and he's growling and yapping like he is angry, which is, this is the behavior that he does if he is angry. I mean, he doesn't bite me, but this is the behavior of an angry dog. But after the play bow, it does not mean that he is angry anymore.
it will still be a bite, and he and in the way that this bite means that he outsmarted me and kind of won. But it's still there's a change there, and all of these things. I mean, it's not articulated through language, because I don't think that dogs think in language, despite how you might see on TikTok or Instagram that someone's taught their dog to speak by pushing some buttons. But there seem to be some... Yeah, anyway, I don't want to go down thinking about that. But dogs don't think in language. Language is a human thing. So obviously he doesn't think any of those things, and you don't think that he thinks those things. But that is still what that bow means. It means that I am now... The meaning of the things that I do will change. So it's already here. This is interesting, I find. It's that a dog has this sense of meaning that he's now swapping into an altered state of meaning, which I love that. Anyway, back in the forest, we've walked up the steep hill with the mountainous bits and rocky bits, and then we're into the proper forest, and the dog, Teddy, little fox-like thing, is bowing with his eyes locked on me. And I'm standing electrically still. And slowly, slowly, I start crouching into a ready-to-leap, ready-to-attack kind of posture. And he sees it, and he knows that we're playing, and that this is different from when he chewed on one of my sponge foam dove magic props, when he chewed that asunder in my room, and I take on a similar posture in anger. Then he cowers in fear or shame, and fear and shame, and he's like, if I continue doing that, he might even pee a little bit on the floor because he's so scared. But now it's the same kind of stuff that what I would do if I would get really angry, which is I very rarely do in general, or particularly with this sweet little dog. But anyway, in this moment, I'm bending down and I'm trying to look scary and I'm trying to look tense, like I'm about to pounce on him, but he knows that we are playing. So he just lies there with his bum in the air, looking straight at me, and I'm doing the I am scary posture, and he is loving it. We are equal and anything goes. The hierarchy, which he engages in to a fault, he is such a submissive, and he knows he has chosen me as the leader and my wife as second and my daughter as the bottom. And if I call for him, he comes running, even if he's with a dog in heat. That just happened the other day. My sister's dog was in heat, and I didn't need to call him, because mine is a Pomchi and the other is a very large dog. So needless to say, as we were eating dinner at my mum's house, my little dog walked on two legs for the 2 hours that we were there, walking next to the other dog, not reaching up to get to the business end of the female dog. But anyway, I called on him, said, come here, come here. And he did. He comes, even when he's with the dog in heat, he comes over. So he loves the hierarchy, and he plays it all the time, working out where everyone and everything is. But when we are playing, this is completely gone. So I'm standing there ready to pounce, and sometimes I lunge for him, but sometimes also I run away full pelt, and he doesn't know what it's going to be. But in a split second, the little dog knows the game. It's chase or it's being chased, and either he runs after me or he runs away, depending on what I offer. And his face and whole gestalt, his whole body language, it just screams enjoyment. And I think that in these moments in wild pursuit where anything goes, I think these might be the happiest moments of his life. Barking and running in the forest and jumping up. And if I am too slow at running after him, he literally jumps up, jumps 360 several times and is snapping at my feet. It's wonderful to see. He plays, and in this play, he finds total freedom. He is not worried about anything or anyone, or that I am angry or whatever. Anything goes. But play is a fine-tuned behavior with its own kind of organic rules. You can bite, but not too hard. But what is too hard? What's too hard? It's fluid. If we're playing rough and we're playing hard, then he can bite hard and I can grab him hard without him becoming afraid. And if one of those play bites that he does accidentally becomes too hard, or one of my pushes hits him, you know, unintentionally hard in the game, then the game just instantly ceases. He quickly assesses the situation, looking at me like if he's bitten me, then he's like, look, did we just break the rules? Did I bite you? Maybe I'm angry. Is the game over? And his face and posture becomes like a question mark. And if I now use an angry tone, his ears go from straight up to flat back against his head. And if I continue with the unhappy demeanor, he will lay down and eventually lay down on his back, baring his throat and his balls. Whilst if I just pet him and give him verbal assurance, oh, good boy, that all is well and that the game is still on, then he can just be straight back into it. Just he bites me and then he goes, ooh, that was a bit wild, and he's looking and he's like compulsively licking my hand, and he goes, okay, everything is there. We know a rule break was a mistake. Relieved, we both understand that the rule break was an accident. I pushed too hard, he bit too hard, doesn't matter. Game on! And the hardness of the bite, or the roughness of the play fight, which would constitute the rule break, like, what would be a rule break? That depends on the intensity of the game, because games can escalate in intensity to a point where bites are actually painful, but it can still be a game. And he could be snarling, showing his teeth, and being so excited. It can be quite rough and violent, but it's still play. But even in the midst of this, a rule can be broken. And it's, you know, exactly when it is, it's just when he accidentally bite me under the nail, or I accidentally push him or whatever. The physical manifestation of a rule break might be a bite that's too hard. But I think the unifying rule is not how hard or how wild, but that there is a shift in intention. One has to want to play. One has to want the game to continue. And each little victory when Teddy manages to bite or catch one of my fingers between his jaws, so just marking it, that's not the end of the game. He holds it, so we both know, yeah, you caught me. And then he lets me pull my finger out, and I grab him and push his head or whatever, and immediately that game is now continuing. And if I let him hold my finger like he's bitten it, and I just hold it in his mouth for a while, then he quickly changes to licking it so as to reassure me that, okay, I won, but I still won. We're still playing? We're still playing? Best of friends? Yes? Because there's real intention in Teddy. Like, you can tell he wants to play and he wants to engage in make-believe. So, yeah, so far we've talked about that, how he bows and it's this invitation to play. But if I, you know, he bows, he's ready to play, but if I then go, I just thought of something very important, some important idea about a dog doing a play invitation bow. And I take my phone out, and then he will and start to type some notes about what I'm going to tell you here today. Then he will look at me for a while, and then he goes, oh, there's no intention to play. I invited, but no gameplay. So that's the second bit. There's the bow for invitation, and then there's that one has to want to play. It's a voluntary thing. So, from all of this, it's abundantly clear that a state of play is different from ordinary, everyday behaviors. And this means that it has a definite start and a definite end. Play is something that happens for a certain period in an otherwise everyday ordered reality. You know, with the dog, it's the hierarchy and whatever it is that he's interested in. When are we going to have food soon? Will there be a snack? Or like this, and he knows he's not allowed to beg for food, so he goes and lies down, but he knows that he can kind of look up from his bed. That's on the edge. He can just check if anything falls down or whatever. So it's an ordered reality where he knows his place and I know my place and everything. But when a PlayStation starts, not a PlayStation, if we turn on the PlayStation, no, if a play situation starts and he makes a bow, then this is a different kind of reality. So a play session can only happen when we both want it. If I'm busy writing down some big ideas or formulating a poem as we walk through the forest, his play bar invitation goes unnoticed. No play happens. Likewise, if he's on the trail, as I mentioned, of a female dog in heat, there's nothing I can do to engage him in play. I can't force him to play. Play cannot be forced. If it's forced upon you or the dog, it's not actually real play. Real free play is an entirely self-motivated and voluntary activity. This is something we're going to get back to a lot. So when I decide it's time to continue the walk, my intention changes. And I signal this by some encouraging word, usually, good boy, such a good little boy, yeah, sweet Teddy. And whilst giving him a good pet. And then, I mean, this signals, this is the first part of signaling that clearly to him that play is over. But of course, I stand up as well and I start walking at my other pace, and he immediately, you know, go on and does whatever dogs do in the forest. And as we do this, then game time is over and we have reverted to our communications to whatever I normally do now. That means what it means. A growl from Teddy is again a growl, and an angry stomp from me is again just what it is, expressions of our true state of emotion. There's no layer of pretend or whatever. The game is finished. As the game is finished, Teddy gets back to his dog business, running off to smell some mushrooms or dog markings along the way, and we become two individuals going about our business. But for a moment, we were completely and deeply connected through the shared experience of play. That's not coincidental here, of course, that I say that we are deeply connected through the shared experience of play. It's here already. I hope now that you sense this sort of resonance and this repetition of these words, that play is not showmanship, and showmanship is not quite play. But when we deeply look at it, as Nella pointed out in his book, we find these attributes, playfulness and connectedness or connection, that these are just permeating everything. So, we shared the experience of play. And when we run, me and little Teddy, we run like demented creatures between the trees in the early morning dimness. We're not doing it to get fit. Teddy is not doing it to get out some pent-up anger for me not giving him an extra treat before the walk. Teddy and I play because we enjoy it. Playing together makes us both happy, and I love seeing just how excited he is, because dogs communicate with their whole physical demeanor, like their behavior and a complete gestalt. Like, you can tell by the way the whole dog looks, the way his head is, the way that his legs are, the way that the tail moves, and all these subtle things that when you love a dog and you've played a lot with it, then you can just read the dog through how he behaves. So he's so expressive, and I love looking at that, because when we play, every aspect of Teddy's expression just combines into a picture of happiness, excitement, and of living the life to the fullest while being completely absorbed in the moment. Like, that's what a happy dog looks like. And so when we play, the only reason why we play is for the joy of playing, not to achieve some other purpose. If we run because we want to hurry home, then the activity of running is extremely similar to the running that we do amongst the trees, yet it's not play. So sometimes when we run, it's play, and other times running is just running, and that goes for you too. If you're running because you all of a sudden realize that you're late for an appointment, that's very different than if you are running whilst playing a game of football or basketball with your friends. So this brings us back to what I mentioned before, with intention being what determines whether a bite or behavior is breaking the rules of the game. Play has to do with the intention behind any given activity, and that this is communicated and understood by the other. Like in this case of me and the dog, then it's Teddy that needs to understand it. So play is a very particular state of being. It's a state of relating to each other. And I guess this was something that I talked about in the beginning here, that play is not a thing in itself, but a mode of experiencing and interacting with reality. Along our morning walks, so basically what I'm doing in this thing here, like I'm using this idea of the morning walk to illuminate some of the aspects of play. And as we go along in the morning walks, we can play for sections of time. And we also play in certain sections of the forest, like certain spaces or places invites play. And there is a spot deep into the forest where the forest is made up of leafy trees. And during the autumn, the fallen leaves gives teddies the zoomies. I don't know if you know what that is, but it's like an irresistible, almost demented urge to just run and shove his snout into and through the leaves. And this same kind of zoomy behavior is triggered when I take him to the beach. Like the sand and the fallen leaves triggers an intense desire to play and run and dig, like shoving his face into the sand, so that he gets sand in his eyes. And it's not until later that seems to then dawn on him that, oh, that was maybe not the best idea. It's like, got to sit there and just gently wipe his eyes and try to get the sand out. But anyway, there's something about the space with this sort of soft ground that triggers in him this desire to play. And in this case, the connection or relation that he engages with is not another being. The play is afforded by a certain kind of ground covering. Because when we go get to this space, then he might be less interested in actually engaging me in play. We're reaching the spot in here. There's a little river there on the side, and there's one of those swings that just has a rope that goes down with a perpendicular little log piece that's hanging there. And as we get to that place, he's like, oh, this is where we are. And he starts to run around in this and not fully paying attention to me. So in that sense, a play is about relation, but not necessarily a play is about relations, but it doesn't have to be like between two conscious beings. You can also find a certain place quite interesting and quite inviting for play, or that a certain place affords play. And I know, like, when my daughter can have the same thing with her little mice that I mentioned last episode, she might be sitting somewhere, maybe we're in a restaurant or something, and it's outdoors, and all of a sudden there's some bushes and stuff that just invites her to play. Maybe the bushes are like bonsai looking things, and it just seems like a perfect forest for the little mice, and then off she goes while we wait for our burgers. Yeah. Anyway, back to the dog and myself in the forest, because once we're past that leafy bit where all the leaves are on the ground, it's not long before we end up back on the main path. And as it is a sort of recreational area, you aren't supposed to have the dog loose. But in the parts of the forest where I go, maybe I don't even meet anyone in the off the track there. Not maybe even every week, which is a beautiful thing about Norway. It's like 6 minutes walk from my home, from my house, and I walk out and up past the school and into the forest, and you walk off on this track that goes off the beaten track, and you're all alone, just you and your dog in the forest running and having the best time. But then when we get past this place with the leaves and we get back out onto the gravel road, then I have to call him over, put him back on his leash, and now we walk to get home. We're not just walking for walking's sake. The degrees of freedom has been limited for both of us. The rules of the parkland demands that I have Teddy on a leash, and his only hope now is the dog park. There's a fenced-off area that we have to pass to get to our house. If there are dogs that are sort of in his size, and I have the time, then he gets to go and play there too. But after years of taking my daughter to playgrounds around the world, as we've toured along the way of the showman, I'm tuned to these kinds of places. sections of space created to invite play. There's a lot to say about playground designs and the levels of risk or degrees of freedom and creative play such places invite or don't invite, and what they can allow or afford these days. But this is not a place for critique of modern playground design. I just want to point out now that just like there are places for play for dogs, like the dog park, there are spaces where human play happens, like sports arenas, theatres, carnivals, and music festivals in fields. Although there are particular places and times when play happens, play can also happen at any place and at any time. And like I said above, sometimes running is running, and other times it's a man and his faithful dog companion escaping zombies in a post-apocalyptic landscape, carrying a message of hope to those they love. Playtime is any time, and any time is playtime, at least potentially. All right, I thought I would have time to tell you more about this, but I realized that I actually have quite a lot to say about human play, so I'm going to do a whole episode where I then talk about human play, because there are aspects of play that I think are particular to human beings. So we're going to change the angle, change the viewpoint on play for the next episode, and we're going to talk about play from my daughter's point of view. But there's something exciting coming up here. If you're interested in numerology or you like put any stock into numbers, I don't know what I think about numerology. I'm not even fully sure what numerology is, and I don't know even how I got myself into talking about this here now, because I know nothing about it. But if you're interested in numbers and the coincidence of numbers, next episode of The Way of the Showman will be episode 100. And, you know, if you don't think that going from 2 digits to 3 digits is important, then you didn't live through the end of the last century. In 1999, we were partying like it was 1999, but we were very afraid that as we went to 2000 and they had to swap that first number, and there wasn't even going from adding one digit, it was just changing the digit from 1999 to 200. They thought that was going to blow up the world, basically. And when we were on tour with the Kamikaze Freak Show, I remember we met this bunch of people. They were Americans, and they were like in a band, and they were driving to going to stay at the pyramids because they were going to be there when the whole world collapsed. Now, it's not a spoiler alert to say that actually I was in Australia at the time when the New Year ticked over, and it was an excellent night, don't get me wrong, but there was no apocalypse, unless the afterlife came, and it is mundane as everyday life is here now. So anyway, as we change to episode 100, I'm going to make a very special episode. I'm going to share a recording that I made in 2009 I've done some of these before, but this is going to be more like a story, but it's told through a poem. I went on one of the early dates with my wife, which wasn't my wife at the time, in 2007-8, and I read the entirety of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and I got truly inspired by just this epic, long, convoluted, but beautiful story. It's like, but it's also a little bit hard sometimes to know exactly what it is that's going on, but that it's filled with rifts, as J.F. Martel calls it in when he talks on Weird Studies. That's an excellent podcast that I like. But that there's rifts in it. There's stuff that doesn't quite add up. And I just really like that story, and I like the poem, and maybe I like the time as well, reading poetry on the lawn with my girlfriend at the time. And I decided to write a poem, and I wrote a poem called The Rime of the Ancient Merrier. I was using the word merry as a person that could be like a showman or whatever. But That poem has since evolved and changed in my mind. I've even done some rewrites and stuff of it, but this, what I'm going to share here, the next episode, is the original recording that I made of this poem with the soundscape and everything from 2009. So I'm going to leave it unchanged and unaltered for you to enjoy in the next episode. So thanks for listening with me. And I normally ask you to do something, and this time it is, if you haven't already, click to follow the podcast on whatever app it is that you're using, Spotify or Overcast or the podcast, Apple's podcast, whatever it is that you're using, click follow so that the episode comes down automatically. You can turn it so it still goes to streaming, so you just get a notification that the episode has come in. But it makes the algorithm find me easier, and it makes me very happy when I wake up and see that a whole bunch of you have already downloaded the episode as soon as it came out. It makes me feel like what I'm doing is worthwhile. So I hope it is worthwhile for you. And since you're coming back listening again and again, I'll take that as a given. Until next time, at our 100th anniversary episode, take care of yourself and those you love, and I hope to see you along the way.